let's start talking about what Jewish ethics would be about the question of how to handle end of life issues. So the first issue I have to address is, do we treat life as an absolute objective good, such that the preservation of life always takes precedence over anything else, and there are no circumstances under which one could voluntarily surrender life. So I want to start by reading a story that you haven't seen previously, and doing two 20th century treatments of that story, introducing one 20th century treatment of that story. That I'll use an introduction to a second story that you have read, where we'll do two 20th century treatments of that story, and that will lead us to a discussion of the use of non-legal text in the construction of Jewish medical ethics. Okay, the first story, which is first number 3 on your sheet, which is unfortunately on page 2. It's my fault for usually at least page numbers out, this time it's a little special. So this is a text from the Talmud in Sota, and it's about the Brigadoon of Jewish literature. The town that sort of exists outside normal kind of space. It's the city of Luz. Now the city of Luz is rabbinically constructed out of a biblical narrative, and how it gets there is not so important to us, though it's fun. I can't resist. The city of the race, there's a biblical narrative about a town, a Canaanite town, which is conquered by the Jews when a particular Canaanite shows them the entrance to that town via a tree. There's a tunnel into the town through the roof of the tree. So the Talmud decides, well, this town, and as a result, he's rewarded, and he gets to go build another city called Luz. And the king rewards him and says, well, that is the town's name up till now. Now the problem is that town is in an area which has been destroyed many times. So it has to sort of make this for it to still be an eternal city of Luz, which is what the Talmud takes to that status, it has to somehow be in this ultimate reality. Now the way this happens is that the town's name is Luz, so the Talmud assumes that Luz is a chestnut. So the Talmud assumes that the town is called Luz because it's impregnable. And the only way in is through the roots of a Luz, which is a chestnut tree. And in this town, the other thing you have to know is that apparently in the ancient Near East, there was a belief that when physical resurrection happens, there has to be some part of your body left from which the rest of you could be resurrected. And the thing about the thing which was left of you is called the Luz Shedeshedra, the chestnut at the base of the pine. And if all these things are combined, where chestnut, right, there's a town which is like a chestnut, which is only entered through the root of the chestnut tree, and you have the chestnut which is the base of the spine, you get this immortal town. Okay, here are some of the things that happen in this immortal town. So Luz is a town in which they produce the phthalate dye. Phthalate is the blue dye that the Torah requires that you put on two feet on your children. Now it seems to be historically identified with, I think, the royal blue in the Roman Empire, but the Roman Empire, I believe, had a monopoly on it and therefore banned the production of it by Jews. And so over time it became this legendary. This legendary thing as opposed to a physical thing. There's a whole question now about whether or not we have successfully reclaimed the secret of Phthalate, but at the time the Talmud is writing, Phthalate is legendary. Alright, so Luz is the town where they sold back Phthalate. Luz is the town where Sennacherib, the Assyrian, came when the Assyrian Empire engaged in population transfer on the conquered territories to avoid local rebellions. So when Sennacherib came, even though he transferred the population of everybody in the area of Luz, he left the town of Luz intact. And then we get to one night, well, the Asmalach HaMavet Ein Lo Rishut La'avor Bo. An angel of death had no permission to enter the town of Luz. It's the impregnable chestnut. He hasn't found the tree. Ella, the Canaan, or some text has the Canaan of the Kenosha, rather the elderly people in it. Now here we have two different texts. One text says, Bizman Shita'asan Katsa Alehem, when their mind is oppressive to them. Another text says, Shaven Shahim the Kenim Harte, when they get really, really old. Then we have two texts again. One is Yotin, as they leave, and the other is Mosin, they go out. Outside of the city walls, the Haymakim and they die. Okay, now what does this story tell us about Jewish conceptions of life? Now, first of all, we have to talk about, is this an important text or is this just a side text? So I like to argue that one way you can tell whether a narrative has legs in the tradition, is, so first of all, I like to analogize metrics to fan fiction. When you tell a version of a story that so well explains the original story that people take it as part of the original story from now on. Right, so if you kind of tricky. Right, so that, 150 books on the original Star Trek, there are only 3 of them that are ever quoted in other books. So those are good measures. Right, the others don't count. So one of the interesting questions is, right, when you see something narrative, does anybody else ever, anything else ever built off it? So this one actually does have something else. There's another story in the Talmud that makes sense only if you know about this, which is the story where King Solomon sees the angel of death crying at some point, and he asks him, why are you crying? And the angel of death says, I'm crying because there are those two handsome servitors of yours that I'm supposed to kill tomorrow. And Solomon, of course, agreed to do the angel of death would be a tragedy if they were to die. And so he takes these servitors with him, he knocks them on satyr, and sends them off to Luz, where they meet the angel of death, outside the wall. And next day, the angel of death is laughing, and Solomon asks him why. He says, the reason I was crying yesterday is that I was thinking, I have to kill these two servitors tomorrow, and there's no way physically I could get them to the right place where I'm supposed to meet them. you set them on these miraculous scenes to get there. But that story only makes sense if you know that Luz is the place to go to detect people in the angel of death. This is an important story in that sense, that it's part of, you can assume, you can assume in a Vedic culture that people know that story and you can build off it. Now, what does it tell us? It seems on the surface to tell us that at a certain point, life is no longer worth living, and it is legitimate at that point for people to go out and get into a death. Life isn't always good. There comes a time when life is no longer worthwhile. Now, let's take a look at how this is treated by the 20th century Sicilian Ezra, the Ezra Waldenberg. That was one of the great medical ethicists of the 20th century. This is verse number 4, that is first Hebrew that in English. So, right, so he's responding to a letter from somebody. Now, this somebody makes an assumption, which is what we probably heard already in the standard notion, which we'll address, that Judaism makes a sharp distinction between actively causing death and somehow allowing death to happen. So the person, the rabbi, Reverend Oldenburg, says, how do we reconcile this with the story of the elders of Luz? It looks like they actively go out and welcome death. And so if we assume that the normative Jewish position, however we know that, is that there's this sharp distinction and you can never actively cause death, then how do we reconcile this? So he says, hey, well, maybe the proper text is they take them out from beyond the wall and not they go out from beyond the wall, and so they're really just passively, allowing their death as opposed to maybe it's even evil people in the city who take them out of the wall, right? This is a text that's condemned. The city of Luz, is a horrible thing, that this happens. Maybe the law for Gentiles is different than the law for Jews, and Luz is a Canaanite city. And all these efforts get made to tell us that this story, right, finally makes the Redu Maral, which is maybe the whole story's allegory, and doesn't tell us anything about, right, about physical death at all. At the end of which, the story has absolutely nothing to tell us about death. That's an interesting way of getting rid of it. I should also point out that the story also has resonance in contemporary culture, and that George Louis Borges has a short story called The City of Immortals, which is the rewrite of this narrative. It seems that now it's a great deal of an acquisition. But a lot of this stuff, he writes like an interesting combination of bad westerns and capitalistic short stories. Exactly. Some of the short stories are brilliant, and some of them are just a pretty peculiar combination of bad westerns and capitalism. Okay, the next story is a story that you're all familiar with. I'm going to keep it to you in context. Narrow context. There's a much broader context and getting to a narrow context. The story is that Rabbi Yossi ben Chisholm, the leader of the Jews in the period of Roman conquest, and he became ill, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Trajan went to visit him. And Rabbi Yossi ben Kisna said to Rabbi Yehuda ben Trajan, why are you still fighting to preserve Jewish identity? God loves the Romans, they won. Give up. And it's right, and there's right, you shouldn't teach Torah anymore, we should just go away, because obviously if God, right, God, if the Romans are winning, God loves them, right, God loves them. Right, so what are you doing teaching Torah in public when the Romans are going to kill you for that? And if he didn't mention John says something, he says, they will have mercy from heaven, right? He says something pious. If Yosef Kisna says, can I say sensible things to you, and you respond that they'll have mercy from heaven, what does that mean? I would be astonished if they don't burn you with the Torah scroll together with you. And then Rabbi Hanina ben Yossi has this interesting conversation in which Rabbi Hanina ben Yossi says, well, okay, if the Romans will kill me, do I go to heaven or not? And Rabbi Yossi gets to ask, have you done anything wrong in your life? And the thing that comes up is this really obscure thing he once did, commingling accounts in a way which he spent more than the right amount, but he spent it like that, but he, unfortunately, he spent it on the wrong account. And Rabbi Yossi gets to say, that's the worst thing you've done, you're going to hell, you're fine. So Rabbi Hanina ben Yossi goes on teaching Torah. And the Romans catch him, and they take him out to be burned. And then there's this really powerful dialogue which, you know, which produces many great works of art. He's sitting there, he's wrapped in a Torah scroll, there are water soaked tufts of wool all over his body, right? And they've lifted, they're bringing out the snake. And they bring out the snake, and, you know, with water soaked rags on it, he's going to die slowly. His daughter says to him, like, why do I have to see this way? And he says to her that, don't worry, I know that God will avenge the Torah, and he will avenge the Torah. And the students say, what do you see? And he says famously, the parchment is burning, the letters are flying off the desert. That's the artwork of the Canaanite fashion. Okay, then, the executioner says to him, or the students say to him, why don't you open your mouth and die that way? I'm not going to quibble with the physical facts, but he thought he could die immediately. He opened his mouth and left the flames into his mouth. And he has this awesome line. Better is he taken my life. Better my life be taken by the one who gave it, and let I should not injure myself. Okay, so that's an absolute line that you never, never, ever give up on life. But if God wants his life, he can take it himself. I'm not doing anything to die faster. Then the executioner asked him, well, what about if I make the flame hotter and I take the wool off? I take the wool away from you to die faster. What about that? Will you put me into heaven? And he says, sure, you'll go to heaven if you do that. And the executioner says, swear to me. And he swears. And so they, right, and the executioner takes off the water-soaked wool and increases the fire, and he dies. It's kind of anticlimactic after that line. Better, right, better than what I take it. Then the executioner jumps into the fire. And our heavenly voice comes out and says, they're all going to heaven. So we have a statement which says that you can never do anything to hasten death. Then, sure, you're going to heaven if you hasten my death. And then somebody commits suicide. And goes to heaven. Right, so this is a problematic story. in terms of trying to derive norms from the story. Now, here are two 20th century pieces of the story. The first, again, is by the Sicilianus. So the Sicilianus says, and I want to look at the last paragraph on the, right, this is part of the same truth as previously, where but he wants to know a verse by it. If you're allowed to passively have your death happen, why is there a famous Shadion? And furthermore, I see a second way of answering your difficulty on the basis of what I thought you now felt right, that legally the Chinese Ben Trajan was permitted to injure himself. That so is getting right, that where one is scared of suffering, one is permitted to wound oneself. Okay, so now all of a sudden he says, actually, the rule is that all the rules about preserving life in Judaism don't apply if the reason that you are dying is to avoid pain. We have to figure out what the standard of pain is, but pain all of a sudden becomes a permission to shorten life. Now, what about the human insurance? Why did he write that the case? Why did he just open his mouth? So he said, oh, he was behaving routinely shuratim. He didn't have to, he couldn't open his mouth, but he was engaged in what we call extra legal piety. So the way Rabbi Waldenberg removes the normative course of the story is by saying that the action of Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, when he refused to hasten his death, that wasn't the law. That was somebody behaving in accordance with someone beyond the law. Okay. Now, we turn the page and we go to verse number 7, which is Moshe Feinstein's treatment of the same thing. And so, first of all, what he says the following. And therefore, he thinks that there's no way to, he's trying to figure out the reverse. How can we justify the executioner hastening his death? If we have a rule, you can't hasten death. So he says, therefore, this is in the last paragraph again, and therefore, the fifth line, and therefore we are compelled to say that there was a situational extra legal ruling on the Fidei Ben Tradion, the Levi's term of the Torah Asha'a, meaning that really legally the Fidei Ben Tradion was not allowed to let the executioner increase the claim, but in his situation, somehow he knew that the law could be suspended. So he acted in a manner which was utterly illegitimate under law, but in accordance with some kind of specifically situational evidence. So we have a story which contains contradictory indications. Right? One time where he refuses to allow his death to be hastened, the other time which he allows his death to be hastened. One person says, well, the time when he refused, that was doing more than he had to. And the other person says, the time he allowed it, that was doing less than he had to. Now, those two strategies can be applied to remove the normative force of any narrative. Any narrative you can claim either the character behaved beyond the letter of the law, so you can't learn anything from him that other people have to do, or you can say the character behaved just in that situation, but really the law isn't that way. So those two shuvot together end up completely removing the capacity for any narrative to be a source of law. Right, now that's an important question, because when you want to end up in Jewish medical ethics as law, what you've done is say that we're only going to allow narratives to influence law if you already know what the answer is. And that doesn't make it very powerful at all. Now, there are other ways of reading the story. To me, if you look at the story not as an attempt to produce norms, but as a literary phenomenon, the point of the Rav Ben Tradion story is that his teaching Torah is an act of defiance against God. Because his teacher told him that God wants the Romans to win, and you should stop teaching Torah. And what he says is, no, if God wants Torah to die, he's going to have to make Torah die. I'm not going to give up. So of course, when the students say, open your mouth and let the flames kill you, he said, no, I'm not making it easy for God. If God wants me to die for teaching Torah, he's going to have to kill me. Now the Romans, however, had no objection whatsoever doing that, because the whole point is God has to save him from the Romans if God wants Torah to survive. So letting the executioner do it is no problem at all. And I think that's the proper literary reading of the story, in which case the story has absolutely nothing to do with Jewish norms about life and death. It's all about a particular rabbi in a particular religious situation. And I think it's important to understand that Talmudic narratives are not necessarily, but Talmudic narratives often create as literary devices. They allow legal assumptions that aren't really quite true. I'll give you one of my favorite analogies to this. The story of Jephthah's daughter, which probably many of you have heard in Tanakh. We're going to take as the assumption for now what Jephthah actually pledges. Let's assume that Jephthah pledges to kill his blood, to kill the first living thing that comes out of his house when he comes back from war, and the first living thing that comes out of his house is his daughter. So now Jephthah has taken a vow to kill his daughter. What's he supposed to do? Well, the Talmud says what he's supposed to do, of course, is annul his vow. The way we know your vow is you go to the greatest rabbi in your area, and you say, excuse me, I made a vow, but had I known what would happen at the time, I made that vow, you never made it, and the rabbi said, okay, your vow is annulled, and you go on. So the text in Tanakh doesn't say that. The text in Tanakh says he fulfilled his vow. So what could have happened? Just, of course, being a good Gnostic Jew, you know that he was supposed to go annul his vow. I said, yeah, that's not true, they were saying frequently. So the Talmud constructs the story as follows. The high priest at that time was Pinchas, the character from Torah. And Jephthah sent a message to Pinchas saying, please tell him all my vow. And Pinchas said, well, you know, I'm a high priest, you're just some political leader. Obviously religious authority takes precedence over political authority. You come to me and I'll know your vow. And Jephthah says, no, the political leaders have to have authority over religious leaders, you come to me. And this is a line I love quoting, but I think it's like the moment that shows you that a legislator should get certain essential principles of feminism. And the concluding line is, between the two of them, the goal is what? You know, male ego clash, don't get sacrifices. It's a wonderfully telling line. But the point is, this story, nobody thinks that you're supposed to fulfill a vow to kill somebody. You can't get somebody else to know it. That's ridiculous. Of course the lawyer is not supposed to fulfill a vow to kill somebody. But for the purpose of your intention, we pretend. And that's the law. So I don't think the narrative has to function within the actual halachic context. So, by the other hand, if I'm engaging in order of halachic discourse, I have to summarize that's a reasonable assumption of the system. For our purposes, I'm going to say that I think that if you put the two silhouettes and the English Moshe and the Feinstein and the Wolfberg together, you discover that narrative tells us nothing whatsoever about end-of-life issues on a legal level. But on the other hand, what if you think of the story of the City of Immortals, the story of the City of Luz, as a reflection on, it really is, it's a reflection on the question, directly on the question of, would it be great to live forever? And the answer is no. It wouldn't be great to live forever. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that, granted that you won't live forever, you shouldn't try to live as long as possible. Right? I mean, if you were to live forever, at some point life would no longer be valuable. Right? Mortality, but it might be that it's the fact of mortality that gives life value. But what the story tells you is that we can conceive that life is not objectively a value as such. There are circumstances in which we can imagine that there are things more important, or that life, not that anything more important than life, but it's just that life itself is no longer worthwhile. We don't have any guidance as to how to apply that in real life circumstances. That's what I would think emerges from this, is that Jewish tradition acknowledges the possibility that life as such is not always lived, but we don't have any specific guidance that comes from that. Okay, second set of issues that shows up, which is the premise to the text is on a preface to the text is you often find text cited about the law of the ghost. Okay, the ghost is, we will translate for now, as the dying person, and on a pure precedential physicalist level, we might want to say it's somebody whose death is presumed inevitable within 72 hours. Okay, it's a natural cause. Well, not because the greatest assassin of all time is born to kill all of this, or something like that. So now the rule here is that I'm only giving you the Hebrew on this, but I'll take you through it because it's already really made just in Hebrew. There's a text which is taken as normative in all of Jewish traditions that the ghost state is considered alive for all purposes. And the ghost is alive for all purposes. So that seems to indicate that even at the moment of the last stages of dying, life is no less precious. Okay, that's a normative statement. It's very hard to get around that statement as such. Now, what develops from there, and this I have to teach you because it affects the interpretation of other stories, is there are two texts that continue from that statement that ghost is alive for all matters, which give you a list of things that you can't deduce from the ghost. Both of them state that you cannot close the eyes of the ghost. And if you do close the eyes of the ghost, that is considered to be the equivalent of bloodshed, and it's manslaughter. So that again seems to be a clear indication that life objectively does not become less valuable just because there's less of it left. And even if you cause the person, the dying person, to die somewhat sooner by closing their eyes, then that is considered bloodshed. And I think that has to be taken as a given in Jewish ethical discourse. But what happens after that is there are two versions of the text, and we don't have time to trace how they happen. One version of the text that treats closing the eyes as a unique phenomenon. You're not allowed to close the eyes, because closing the eyes causes death. Another tradition treats closing the eyes as an example of touch. And if any touch which in any way moves any part of the ghost is likely to kill them and therefore is considered murder. Now, if you take that understanding, then a whole lot of things start shifting. For example, lots of tests to determine if you want to determine range of FPS for such a person. And most tests of whether someone is alive or not required testing. So all sorts of decisions we make become impossible. Now, because of this, right, Einstein and Thompson that I think I decided here, we're not going to go through, basically eliminates the whole category of ghosts and we can't recognize it now. Because we understand that that interpretation would make all sorts of normal things that go on in hospitals utterly impossible, would make being an orthodox doctor impossible. So he basically eliminates the category by saying that we can't, right? We don't know what a ghost is, right? The only people who know what ghost are, I think there are, he talks about the cover condition, but anyone who reported a particular cat named doctor that was really very good at knowing who was dying and who was not, and it was like, you know, well, nursing home with a cat named doctor, if someone was dying, would it curl up in your bed? Like, you call the relative. I don't doubt doctor, but I thought it was done in the story. Okay, but and the reason this matters to me today is that many later authorities will interpret, work on the assumption that everyone believes is forbidden to touch a ghost. And therefore, they will read all subsequent texts on the assumption that it is forbidden to even touch a ghost, and that changes the interpretation of the later text. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that in fact, the correct text is one which treats closing the eyes as a unique phenomenon, which has something to do with the eyes being the window of the soul. And if you close the eyes and you know, so the sort of makes forces of the soul which are hanging out in the eyes to make a choice, does it go in or out? When you close it, it's gotta go out. Something like that, I don't know, right? I think that's probably what the original understanding is. I can do an involved textual argument which I can show you how I think the error crept in. But I also have to tell you that is not the way in which most of the Jewish tradition has understood the issue for the past, you know, at least 600 years. So that's where we get to the issue of whether you're interested in a coherent argument or a tradition argument. Okay. So that brings us to the test, right? This is pretty much what you have up until the 13th, you know, the 12th century. That's just what there is. You have a bunch of stories, you can tell the others, but all of which are showing you can gather any story you want. And you have a text that says the ghost space is like the living for all matters, and gives you a list of things you can't do to kill the ghost space. Okay, then the paper has to begin in Germany, which is kind of like late 12th century, I think, writes this really enigmatic text, which he says the following. He starts off with this marvelous double negative, which is not equal to positive. You cannot cause a person, right, one must not cause a person to not die rapidly. Now, that does not mean that you must cause a person to die rapidly. Be careful, right? Right? Amplitude is, you know, only got trouble. Isn't it double negative or positive? All right, good point. Isn't that what double negative is? I know now. And by the way, say it's like, you know, one was not supposed to, right, to not do well on tests, or I should not play loud, right, play loud rapidly during a test. It doesn't mean I should get any answers. Right, there's a difference between not causing someone to not die rapidly and causing someone to die rapidly. Right, that's our principle. Right? Don't cause someone to not die rapidly. Now here is the reason for it. It says four examples that were addressed. Now that four examples can be crucial. Because it seems that his principle is not just about the dying person, but the dying person and people who are like the dying person. Now here he has four rules. He says, if there is a wood chopper in the name of the dying person, which is preventing the soul from leaving, you can remove the wood chopper. You must remove the wood chopper. A. B. Alright, if you might be able to keep him alive longer by putting salt on his tongue. Again, I'm not interested in whether this is medically true or not. Right. Now, you might be able to keep a person alive longer by putting salt on his tongue. Don't do that. But if he tells you, I can't die here, you need to move me. Right? You need to move me, you know, there's a tree in the town I grew up in, whatever, that's an old episode of some TV show, I don't know, I can't die, right, until I go back to my hometown to this tree and then I can die. Or in another room. You can't move him into the other room. Take the witch chopper away, don't hold up saw on his tongue, but don't move him to the other room to allow him to die. And if he's in a burning building, you have to rescue him. Now, that again, like the story of the thing that's right down, that sounds like there are a lot of contradictions engaged in here. On the one hand, you can't cause him to die more slowly. So take the wood chopper. The wood chopper is preventing him from dying rapidly. Take the wood chopper away. The soul would cause him to not die rapidly. Don't put the salt on. The room apparently is not causing him to not die rapidly. The room is apparently keeping him alive. Don't stop that. And life saved him from burning buildings. It's still alive, okay, right? But I'm alive, right? I'm taking the wood chopper away. And right, at the same time, right, so you know, right, you know, so there's a wood chopper there, right, keeping him alive, right, and the building's on fire. And right, shoo, well, I take it away, let it die, while I'm dashing the building, trying to carry it out.
Do we have to
either
live or die on the 6 foot?
Well, that's a great thing. If living back for internal reasons, except, like, what, why is the room an internal reason?
Why is the wood chopper keeping you alive?
Apparently, like, when you're annoyed, you just can't die. And it's just bang.
You want to add to the fire?
And I don't know, it's not related to the fire. I think that, you know, this is different than it is. Okay, now this text, stationed there happily in 12th century Germany for 300 years or so, and no one notices it. So the Sacred Septuagint is a difficult, is a disorganized book that you really have to really want to know it. This text doesn't make it. But all the texts in the early 16th century, the work of the Schulte Boren discovers it. And at that point, he introduces it into a discourse, and then everything, all Jewish conversations about end-of-life issues since the year 1500 have all been based around the Sefer Chassidim and the treatment of it in the Shulte Givorim. So here's what the Shulte Givorim says. So he says he was engaged in a fight against people in his town who had the practice as follows. When there was a person dying, and they couldn't die, kind of they weren't able to die, the neshama could not leave. What they would do is they would shove the pillow out from underneath them because they said that the feathers of the pillow were causing the person not to die. So they removed the pillow from the right, from the dying person in order to enable the person to die. Now the author of this Shulte Givorim thought this was a terrible thing. And he has fun with it. Really, really, really is fun and funny. So he's talking about it. They say that their feathers, you know, there's a bird feathers inside the pillow, keeping from dying. And for years, I screamed like a rooster against this practice. But nobody listened to me. Nobody listened to me. In fact, my teachers disagreed with me, and there was this great rabbi, Rabbi Nathan Hungarian, who wrote this is perfectly fermented. Right, so he's studying this lonely battle. But it tells you this popular practice in the 16th century Italy was that when a person was apparently having difficulty dying, you would pull the pillow out from underneath them so that they would die more rapidly. At one point, the Shulte Givorim says, aha, but now I found the Sefer Chassidim. The Sefer Chassidim supports me. Now, why do you think the Sefer Chassidim supports him? They said, look, because the Sefer Chassidim says you can't move the dying person to a different room. So if you can't move him to a different room, then he can't take the pillow off from underneath him. Then he says, well, you know what, it's true that the Sefer Chassidim does say you can take the wood chopper away. And he does say that you don't have to put the salt on his tongue. And then he makes a leap. He says that not only do I believe the Sefer Chassidim says that you don't have to put the salt on the tongue, he also understands Sefer Chassidim is saying that if there is salt on the tongue, you can remove it. Right, the way he frames it is, anything which you should not have put there, you can now remove. Now, the critical thing here is that there are two ways of understanding what he says here. One possibility is that what he's saying is that if you did something illegitimate to prolong life, you can undo it. And the other is that, the other way of saying it is that there, in circumstances in which you don't have to, which you would not, but things that you would not wish to do to prolong life, you can remove. Right, those are different statements, right? Those are different statements, and the very clear nachmanin, the practical difference is, suppose somebody was put on a respirator at a time when there was still a chance they would live. So you put them on the respirator legitimately. So if you take the reading which says that you can undo something long it is, then you can't take patients off respirators later. If you take the reading as anything that you wouldn't have to do, you can remove, and if you wouldn't have to put them on the respirator, you can remove them. That's a huge difference. As it happens, apparently, an emergency room protocol is that when somebody is brought in, you immediately put them on life support. And so in practice, if we said that you could never take somebody off life support once they were on them, the permission to remove them to remove life support would be no good at all. Yes?
I guess I don't understand why there's a lot of medical on. Like, that you need to be so sick that you're not allowed to use medicine.
Well, so now we have to figure out what's the difference, right? We have to ask the issue. What's the difference between salt, between putting salt on somebody's tongue and leaving them in the same room? Right? Why can I take this? Well, he made it more radical, right? The wood chopper, we could say, okay, the wood chopper is not associated with his body. That's unique. That's a different case. Well, why would he say that I can remove the salt from somebody's tongue and yet I can't move them from one room to another? That's a really hard thing to explain. So what he says, right, what he says is, so the distinction that makes sense to him is that you cannot do anything that will start with the paragraph beginning, but to do something that will cause his rapid death, right? But to do something that will cause his rapid death on the exit of his nephesh is forbidden, and therefore it's forbidden to move the nephesh from his place and to leave him in another place so that his neshama will exit. And therefore, it's also written to place the keys of the synagogue under the head of the goatess, he will die rapidly. Because this also sees the exit of the nephesh. I have no idea why. Right, so now, right, I have a theory that it may be a typo that actually originally, or maybe a borrowed string, if you have a folklorist, that it may originally have been the keys of the cemetery. And I can't prove that in any way. And it may have been borrowed from Christianity. The cemeteries around churches, so the keys to the church, which were the keys to the cemetery, became the keys to the synagogue, even though it didn't make any sense at all by that point. Because Jews cannot put cemeteries around synagogues because Kohanim wouldn't be able to come to the synagogue now. Okay. So he says this as well, according to this, if there is something that is causing his soul not to exit, it is permitted to remove that cause. And there is nothing to this, as behold, he is not resting his finger on the lamp, which is the analogy that we had earlier for closing the eyes of the ghost face, it's resting your finger on the lamp. And he's not doing a deed. But to rest something on the ghost face, or to transport from place to place, so that the shaman will exit rapidly, seems certainly forbidden, since indeed he is placing his finger on the lamp. So, the distinction he makes he says on the one hand there's the difference between speeding the exit of nephesh and removing something that is causing the soul not to exist. But he has an additional formulation here, so therefore he's not resting his finger on the lamp and is not doing a deed. This is an interesting formulation. When you're taking salt away, why are you not doing a deed? Right, so on the one hand, there's one distinction which is very hard to figure out what he means. How do you tell when you're causing the soul to exit more rapidly or preventing the soul from exiting more fully? Right, that seems like almost a semantic distinction. And on the other hand, there's a claim that this isn't an action. Well, in what sense is it not an action? Now, that formulation in the normative code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, so the Moshe Yisraelis, who lives immediately after the Shulchan Aruch, he formulates it this way. And his last, right, he says that if you remove the salt from the tongue, it says there is not, last line of the verse number 12, there is not in this any deed at all, rather he is removing the prevention. He is making ceremonia. Right, so he seems to frame it, the very formal legal category. You can put that removing preventions is not considered a deed, and you can allow a debt if you're not doing anything, but you cannot cause a debt. Now this distinction has a lot of resonance for some reason outside of Jewish circles, because somehow people have this accords powerfully with an intuition that somehow murder is always killing, is always wrong, but there are people who keep alive. Right? So that understanding has a great deal of universal power, even though it's very hard to make sense of it. So here I want to introduce a notion from Baruch Brody again, which he calls pluralistic ethics, in which he makes the claim that actually there are all sorts of basics. There are also all sorts of fundamental theories of ethics. Six categories, I think, where the three easy ones are virtue ethics, where you talk about what makes you a better person. Deontological ethics, where you just talk about whether this is the right thing to do, and irrespective of circumstances, and consequential ethics, where you talk about whether this yields the right consequences. And what is fun is that real life people people have consistent claims. They recognize that each of these kinds of claims has power. So the way he accounts for this distinction is that from a consequentialist perspective, people think these people should be dead. From a deontological perspective, killing is wrong. So we try and find a way in which the action of killing is less an action of killing, so that the deontological claim is weaker, and therefore you can accept the consequentialist claim that this person is better off dead, or society is better off with this person dead, or is not occupying medical equipment. So he argues essentially that we can surrender conceptual coherence on a philosophic level in order to account for these conflicting intuitions. Now I don't know how well that fits with the normal methodology of halakha, which is that we sort of throw up our hands and give up any attempt at coming up with a really coherent formulation. Now I'll give you an example where the Hero Knesset tries to solve this issue by passing in a Israeli hospital started to take a function in accordance with halakha. So the solution they came up with was to put all respirators on timers, so that you never actually have to turn respirators off, you just have to not turn them back on. And that was a way of codifying this intuition. I really thought that was not a good solution. It's not really supposed to make sense. It works fairly well. Or if you assume that halakha is just wrong, but we have to work around it, it works. I don't like either of those solutions. What I want to point out, however, is that there is a way of I want to read one of the sources of you, and then we'll present one of the sources. So again, here we have this is source number 14. Tito Yezner addresses a theoretical question of end of life circumstances. And he has, but his presentation of the case is very powerful. So we take a look at the line, why it matters is, it must be emphasized, the first word of the line. Okay? It must be emphasized that the question arises only when in the doctor's evaluation the condition of the patient is critical with the hope of being saved, and this essentially is the purpose of preventing the continued hard suffering of the patient, and to allow him to die in itayefa, a death of dignity, and not to degrade him through his transformation without purpose, into a figure with many tubes that destroys the cell and elokim within him, destroys the image of God within him. Now that's a really powerful presentation of the question. And the first issue we have to talk about is there any real warrant in Jewish tradition for making the claim that becoming a person with tubes sticking out of you somehow diminishes the image of God in you? That's a very strong claim. If you make that claim, then you can activate a whole set of halakhot that talk about the prioritization of dignity over other love. But I have to say that I don't know. The answer to this is Stephen Hawking. And Stephen Hawking not as right. Stephen Hawking was telling the king that his image of God is diminished because his body is kept alive by a series of machines. What about people who are in iron lung, which are in the polio epidemic? And is that right? Do we treat them as not having a telemokin such that it's where they're better off or that they're better off dead? That's a very hard claim for me to make. So I have to present this to you because of all of this, with a tremendous medical ethicist, any fair presentation of Jewish medical ethics has to acknowledge that he took this with a very powerful claim. And I'm telling you, but I will tell you that I find this very problematic in those terms, diminishing the telemokin. I do think that there's a different framework you can come from, which is, which may be connected to it, but Joseph B. Soloveitchik argues that a fundamental element of dignity is the capacity to control your environment. So there are elements of dignity. If you cannot control your environment or your any aspect of your body, there is some element of dignity. People also talk about pain. And I'm always bothered by claims that you want to remove care to prevent pain, because pain is almost always manageable. And particularly if patients are unconscious, nobody really knows what the experience of pain is. And one of the really interesting things is that NPR had a whole study on, they've been doing studies on the brains of patients who are thought to be in vegetative conditions. And discovered at least some of them are just shredded, which is that they have a perfectly reactive mental life, they just had no connection to the human mind and their body. So I am very suspicious. Of claims of certainty about what, right, which makes the argument on the grounds of what is best for the patient. I don't understand. But I'm making that as a personal claim, you know, but I'm saying that most understandings of Jewish medical ethics depend on assertions about what scientific reality are. The Jewish tradition says nothing about whatsoever. You have to understand. And you're going to understand that claims about what Jewish tradition says are often built on claims about what reality is, which, the same way, to go back to the claims about brain death. So like the initial positions that supported brain death in the Jewish tradition are built on the belief that that the criteria for brain death actually measures total lysis of the brain, like brain lymphocyte. And that, now I think everyone agrees that's false. And so you have to go over the idea that it measures some kind of, sometimes diminished activity in the brain, but nothing that you can actually quantify in a, right, as the end of something, and that makes life less hurt. In that sense. Okay. What is the definition of life? The typical answer comes up with a series of ways of understanding the show that you learn, which are really worthwhile if you want to have a comprehensive tradition. But I'm really interested in its source number, is paragraph number 8. And this is where he offers his own opinion. He says, therefore, in my humble opinion, the two distinctions are one. The foundational point that when one removes the cause that he was forbidden to introduce, since it delays death, that status is a sign that this does not bring independent life to the ghost. And therefore one can remove it, as his removal is not an action of interrupting his life, but rather the removal of an external cause that prevents the departure of his nefesh. Now what does that mean? Well, let's look at it again. It says that there are people who are alive, they're alive because of internal causes. And those people you have to keep alive. And then there are people who are not alive because of internal causes. Their life is sort of being infused in them by something outside themselves. And those people you can end their life without any challenge. Now there are two basic problems with this distinction. One is stupidizing. Now, if people on respirators that have their life infused by external forces, so do scuba divers. So is it perfectly fine to cut the tube of a scuba diver, because after all, we're going to get is there losing external life? That's one problem with this kind of distinction. Now, the Tevuk Arav, the kind of lady, tries it differently. So there are people whom God tried to take their soul and you prevented it. And those people you can remove them. But how do you know? If anything else, it's completely beyond me. Another kind of problem with this. So the notion that you can distinguish between external and internal life, right, is a fair attempt to make sense of the tradition of the perspective of the initial figure we're in, but ultimately is just an assertion that can never be verified and can never be, that's just your call, right? What do you think is then, right? Is the medicine infused internal life, is water infused internal life, whatever it may be. The other sense is, right, is to say that we don't talk about whether people are alive or dead, we just talk about whether you're doing an action or not. We distinguish between doing an action and removing a prevention. So here's a scenario. There's a patient in the room hooked up to a respirator. And person A walks into the room with the intention to unplug the respirator. Mm-hmm. Person B walks into the room with intention to shoot them. So the person with the person is about to unplug the respirator, takes out the gun, shoots the person who's about to shoot them, because after all, they're attempted murder. And then unplugs. Because that's absolutely right. Because we're only interested in the act, right? Whether it's a ridiculous possibility. More than that, it is really true that removal of external life is not an action. Then all you have to do is this notion of removal of intervention has, like, we know other ways of creating removal of intervention. There's a whole Institute of Israel which is largely dedicated to coming up with ways to allow us to do things on Shabbat. By constructing switches that are removal of intervention as opposed to action. So now we have all these murder plugs, right? They hook up one of these filming machines into somebody, and you're actually then, you're just, what I want to say is, so the basic problem is any clear formulation has to either say the difference between kinds of action or the difference between kinds of people. I think there are more initiatives, I would read him make a distinction in kinds of action. I think that he doesn't make a distinction between kinds of people. Both of those are impossible. Now, you need to find some kind of combination, but it's not at all clear that anybody has yet constructed a really good combination of that. I think that Jewish medical ethics is in the state, right, with some guidance from tradition, is in the process of trying to construct that way in the same way. It's engaged in the same process that secular ethicists are trying to negotiate that. If you look at my website, I have an attempt to construct one of these things. I'm not telling you that my attempt is the right way to do it. But I think what you get at the tradition is this real sense that there has to be some way to allow people to die, and there also has to be some kind of absolute prohibition against killing, and we're trying to figure out a way to navigate that. Okay, I have a last thing to say. And again, like, one of the challenges of presenting a Jewish medical ethics thing is whether we present is a standard traditional position or present my position. So what I'm trying to do is present you the standard position that my critique is in. And you can figure out where you end up yourself. So the last response is from Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who's one of the great disciples of in Israel of the late 20th century. So he says the following. What he's talking about is morphine trips. And morphine trips are pain relief, like pain relief, pain management. But the issue is, now I'm going to take this as a scientific fact right now. If you look online, you'll see there are all sorts of studies questioning whether morphine trips actually have this impact. But I also think if you look and see that most of the studies that claim it doesn't are dealing with conscious patients and some of them are non-conscious patients. That's a study. Morphine trips, we're going to assume at least non-conscious patients. Morphine, in order to handle pain, you have to keep increasing the dose of your tolerance to morphine happens. At some point, in unconscious patients, you increase the dose to the point where respiration is suppressed and the patient dies. So when you put a patient on a morphine drip, you are starting them on a process which at some point they're going to have to choose between stopping managing the pain and killing them. So the question of that is, are you allowed to do this? And what he says is, in the case before us, the case before us, every sick person seeks and pleads for pain relief, even by damaging means. Right? Everybody wants the pain medicine, even though they know that narcotics are bad for them. And therefore, even though the patient is unconscious, we can assume consent to wanting to stay. B. It is understood that all this is exclusively to release pain, so the likelihood that this will bring a death nearer is like an inevitable but unwanted consequence. So the next point is that even though you know when you put patients on morphine drips that eventually you're going to end up killing them, actively, and so long as the primary purpose of the morphine drip is to release pain, you're allowed to put them on the morphine drip, even though that will end up with actively killing them. Now, this seems really very roughly parallel to the Catholic notion of double effect. He uses terminology drawn from Tractate Shabbat, the laws of Shabbat, when you open your refrigerator door and the light goes on, whether you're responsible for that action or not. Now, reality is that this is how most medical euthanasia happens. And in fact, if you study, when you send patients to hospice care, and you send them to home hospice care, and you give relative instructions about how to manage the dose, so what they tell you is just keep increasing the dose until they stop expressing pain. And they don't even actually give relative instructions about how to keep them alive. And it's pretty clear that in all hospice care, morphine drugs is eventually a form of euthanasia. And it was the study done at BU, which came up with a fairly astonishingly high percentage of patients of euthanasia through morphine drugs. Now if you make the claim that anything you do for pain management is okay, as long as your primary purpose is pain management, then that basically opens the whole world up. To Jewish ethics saying that you can do whatever you want in end of life situations as long as your primary purpose is the good of the patient. I have to say that I find this Shiva with due deference to Rosh Shlomo Zalman, who was an awesome scholar and not misleading. I found this in an utterly astonishing Shiva, which I can't imagine really has echoed elsewhere in literature, but there it is. Okay, so that brings us to our last methodological point. When we say what are Jewish medical ethics, that implies that Jewish medical ethics exist, and our only question is to find out what, our only task is to find out what they are. Another way of looking at it is that Jewish medical ethics don't, in many areas exist at most in a quantum state. And, there could be this, there could be that, and somebody has to measure it, and that determines what the halakha is. Now, the issue here, again, is that for somebody who feels themselves bound by the outcome, that's an interesting thing to say. Good, let's go find out what the tradition is going to tell me to do. If you're looking for somebody outside the tradition who wants guidance, to tell you the tradition right now hasn't said anything yet, doesn't know it at all. So that runs into an issue. So my usual presentation ends by saying, well, look, you see, Jewish tradition could go different ways. There's responses which go in particular ways. I would like it to go in a different way, come tell you. And we'll say it's somewhat different Jewish medical ethics. If we're looking for important Jewish medical ethics into university class, that's a much harder claim to make. And then my challenge is, if I were doing it as an academic, I would have to say that the only Jewish medical ethics about end-of-life issues is that we make a distinction, that we make a dual distinction with the grounds in which are somewhat fuzzy between patients who are alive intrinsically and patients who are alive extrinsically, and acting directly and somehow removing intervention, and that's basically some distinction along that line is what people should come up with. And Jewish tradition at least considers the possibility that we accept the whole effect theory. That would be an accurate academic summary of the literature, although it would also be accurate if you said that actually all public presentations of literature all emphasize the Jewish tradition demands the continuation of life at all costs, because the public health presentations are always polemical, and so actually never say any of these words. That can be three different presentations, the popular presentation, the academic presentation, and me. That's a challenging framework. So I'll leave it to you to figure out which of these frameworks you think is most valuable for you. Whether what you want to use your tradition for is to tell you what to do, to give you guidance for thinking, whether you see yourself as part of the process of creating a Jewish tradition, and you feel inspired to read these texts so that you can be part of creating it. With honesty and in what you believe it is with genuine fidelity to the past. And that, I think, is pretty much my presentation of the voice issue.